I want you to think about, well, think about the last time you read a headline about some major breakthrough in theoretical physics.
Usually it's something about dark matter or string theory.
Right, exactly. And chances are it left you feeling a little disconnected, like maybe it was about 10-dimensional string theory or, multiverses that we literally can never observe.
Yeah, or dark matter that supposedly makes up most of the universe, but just it completely refuses to interact with anything.
Right. And for a lot of us, I mean, physics has kind of started to feel less like a description of the reality we actually live in and more like this abstract, almost broken
Well,
puzzle.
the interesting thing is, we are the only ones who feel that way.
No, we really aren't. Because back in 1958, Niels Bohr, who is, one of the founding fathers of quantum mechanics, he was reviewing a new theory from a colleague. And he reportedly said this amazing quote.
Oh, I love this quote.
It's so good. He said, "We are all agreed that your theory is crazy. The question which divides us is whether it is crazy enough to have a chance of being correct."
It's just a phenomenal thing to say, mostly because Bohr, he understood something fundamental there.
Which is what exactly?
That when a scientific paradigm is hitting a wall, the solution isn't going to look like a minor tweak. It's going to look completely incomprehensible to the establishment.
Just totally crazy.
Exactly. And standard theoretical physics today is definitely struggling. I mean, if you look under the hood of the standard model, physicists are forced to rely on what they call free parameters.
Okay, free parameters. What does that actually mean for the math?
So there are 19 or more of these numbers, like the mass of an electron or the strength of electromagnetism, that are essentially just magic numbers.
Magic number, like they just plug them in.
Yes. They have to be manually plugged into the equations just to make the math work out. Science literally cannot explain why they are what they are.
So today we're going on a deep dive into a text that claims to solve that exact problem. It's called the Noellian Universe Theory, version 3.0, by David Noel Lynch and the Roughly 3K Collaborative.
And this is not a minor tweak.
No, it is not. The mission for you, listening right now, is to prepare to completely deconstruct just about everything you learned in high school physics.
Because we're going to impartially examine this framework, and well, it is undeniably radical. It attempts to derive every fundamental constant from zero free parameters.
Zero. None of those magic numbers.
None. Using pure topology and geometry, we are essentially transitioning from a physics of nouns, where space is this static container and particles are just discrete things sitting inside it, to a physics of verbs.
A physics of verbs, I like that.
Yeah, a framework where reality is an active computing system, what they call an Abraxian engine, that's rendering existence frame by frame.
I'm going to be honest, when I first started looking at the source material, it felt incredibly dense, but you really should care about this.
Oh, absolutely. The implications are staggering.
Because if this text is onto something, it doesn't just fix the math of black holes, it suggests that the past, the future, your own consciousness, and even like that physical ache of grief you feel in your chest.
What the theory calls the Celtic knock.
Right, the Celtic knock. It claims all of that are perfectly calculated thermodynamic outputs of the universe. So let's unpack this. Before we build this new engine, the authors claim we have to diagnose the illness that's infecting the old one.
They call it the Platonic pathogen.
The Platonic pathogen. What exactly is so sick about standard physics?
Well, the sickness is basically conflating the map with the territory.
Okay, the map is not the territory.
Exactly. For over two millennia, stretching all the way back to Euclid's geometry, we've systematically taken our abstract mathematical models and treated them as physical dynamic reality.
So that's the noun grammar you mentioned earlier.
Right. Standard physics treats space as a pre-existing static void, and time is just a fourth spatial axis. This creates what's called the block universe concept.
Which is like a frozen continuum.
Yeah, a frozen block where all past and future events just exist simultaneously, laid out on a grid. But the Noellian universe theory, which let's just call it KUT for short.
Yeah, KUT is much easier to say.
KUT demands a verb grammar. Space isn't a void you can put things into. Space is ash. It's the crystallized historical record of past actualization events.
Let me see if I'm tracking this map versus territory idea. If I have a blueprint of a house, the blueprint is perfect. The lines are completely straight, the corners are exact.
Pure geometry.
Right, but I can't live inside a blueprint. When I actually build the house, there's friction, you know, there's warped wood, there's mortar. So the pathogen is physicists looking at the perfect blueprint of math and assuming the physical universe is made of perfectly straight lines.
That is the absolute core of it. And the most dangerous symptom of this pathogen, according to KUT, is the zero-D point fallacy.
Zero-D meaning zero-dimensional.
Right. Euclid defined a mathematical point as that which has no part. Zero dimension, zero volume. Which is, you know, incredibly useful for drawing triangles on a chalkboard.
Sure, it makes the math clean.
But when modern physics took that zero-D point and said, hey, physical particles can exist as zero-dimensional points, they basically introduced a fatal mathematical bug into reality.
Because, wait, my high school physics is kicking in here. Density is mass divided by volume.
Yes, exactly.
So if you take a physical mass, like, say, a dying star, and you compress it into zero volume, you are dividing by zero.
You are. And in classical general relativity, when you divide a finite mass by zero volume, your energy density goes to infinity.
And that's what a singularity is.
That is what we call the Big Bang singularity, or a black hole singularity. But the KUT text argues these are not profound physical discoveries at all.
What are they, then?
They're arithmetic syntax errors.
Just a syntax error. But hold on. If dividing by zero breaks the math, and, I mean, physicists obviously know you can't divide by zero, how did a zero-dimensional point become the foundation of modern physics?
Well, why didn't someone throw a flag on the play 100 years ago?
Yeah, exactly.
It's all because of calculus. Newton and Leibniz built calculus on the concept of limits measuring things as they infinitely approach zero.
Okay, yeah, I remember limits from calculus.
And it is an incredibly powerful tool for calculating motion and change. The problem arises when you promote a mathematical shorthand to an ontological primitive.
An ontological primitive, meaning like the fundamental building block.
Exactly. Claiming the universe is actually built out of these mathematical limits.
Right.
When you try to build quantum field theory out of zero-D points, you trigger what physicists call the ultraviolet catastrophe.
I've heard that term, but break it down for me. What is actually catastrophic about it?
So, in classical electromagnetism, if an electron is a zero-dimensional point, the electric field it generates becomes infinitely strong as you get infinitely close to the center.
Okay.
And since energy and mass are equivalent, that infinite field energy means the electron should have infinite mass. It should instantly become a black hole.
Which it obviously doesn't.
Obviously. We're still here.
So how did the physics community fix that? Did they just abandon the zero-D point?
Oh, no. They invented a mathematical trick called renormalization. Yeah, they essentially take the infinite result, subtract another infinity from it, and basically just leave behind the finite number they measure in the lab.
That sounds like cheating.
Richard Feynman, who literally won a Nobel Prize for his work on this, openly called renormalization a dippy process and mathematically disreputable.
Wow. Even the guy who won the Nobel Prize for it didn't like it.
Right. It's a patch. It sweeps infinity under the rug just to save the zero-D point.
Which kind of brings up the concept of infinity itself. The tech spends a lot of time tearing down the idea of completed infinity or Aleph null.
Yes, the reification of infinity.
I always thought infinity was just, you know, a really big number that never stops.
Well, pure mathematics treats infinity as a finished, completed set. You could put it in a box and do operations on it.
Okay.
But if you apply a completed infinity to physical reality, things devolve into absurdity really quickly. For instance, string theory requires 10 to the 500th power possible vacuum states.
That is an absurd number.
It leads straight to the multiverse catastrophe, the claim that every possible universe exists somewhere just to make the math balance out.
Oh, right.
Or consider Boltzmann brains. If you have infinite time and infinite space, random thermal fluctuations will eventually spontaneously assemble a fully conscious human brain floating in the void.
Wait, what?
Yeah, complete with false memories of a life on Earth. It's statistically inevitable in an infinite universe.
That sounds like a sci-fi horror movie, not actual physics.
KUT argues that if your theory inevitably produces floating Boltzmann brains, your theory is completely broken. So they replace completed infinity with the law of Noetherian conservation.
And what does that law say?
It states that rendered actuality plus unrendered potentiality equals a total bounded finite capacity. Basically, infinity isn't a finished box. It is merely an open-ended process.
So if KUT throws out the zero-D point and they throw out completed infinity, what do they actually build the universe out of? Like, what is the new pixel?
They introduce the one-by-one-by-one event point as the new geometric primitive. Space is fundamentally quantized.
Quantized meaning pixelated.
Exactly. It's made of indivisible volumetric cubes defined by the Noetherian length. And this length is staggeringly small. It's about 1.6 times 10 to the negative 35 meters.
That is incredibly small. But if space is pixelated and those pixels actually have volume, that fundamentally changes black holes, doesn't it?
Completely.
Because mass can't collapse into a zero-dimensional singularity anymore. It has to hit a physical floor.
Yes. The authors call this the ultimaton ceiling. It is a maximum density limit of approximately 5.16 times 10 to the 96 kilograms per cubic meter.
Okay, so a hard limit.
Right. When a collapsing star reaches this density, the volumetric pixels are completely saturated. They hit what's called causal deadlock.
Well, let me try to put this in computer terms. It's like a hard drive. An event horizon isn't a magical gateway to some bottomless pit. It's literally just the physical boundary of a sector of space that is completely full of data.
That's a great way to think about it.
The system has zero local bandwidth left to write any further updates, so the collapse just stops. That is so much more grounded than a bottomless pit of infinite density.
It is far more elegant thermodynamically.
But this creates a huge conceptual hurdle for me. If space is a pre-rendered grid of hard volumetric pixels, how does anything actually move? I mean, how do these pixels change state?
To answer that, the text completely dismantles our conventional idea of linear time. We have to throw out that block universe we discussed earlier. Time is not a 1D line. KUT presents ternary time.
Ternary time, meaning three parts.
Yes. Time is a three-phase thermodynamic metabolism.
Thermodynamic. Wait, so you're saying time has states of matter, like solid, liquid, and gas?
Conceptually, yes, exactly. The past is the solid phase. They call it the control field. It is rendered irreversible ash.
Okay, ash.
It forms the physical laws and acts as an outward expanding pressure. The future is the gas phase, or the chaos field. It is unmanifest, wave-like potential pulling inward.
Okay, I have the solid past and the gas future. Where is the present in all this?
The present is the liquid phase, the instant field. It is a one-Planck tick-tick phase boundary where the gaseous future condenses into the solid past.
So it's the actual transition.
Exactly. The engine executes this transition in what they term the IR turn.
I really want to visualize this. Imagine a 3D printer.
Okay.
You have the raw spool of plastic filament feeding into the machine. That's the future, right? The gas phase. It's pure, unmanifested potential. It could become literally anything.
Perfect analogy.
And then the hot nozzle where the plastic is melting, actively being shaped in that exact moment, that's the present, the liquid phase. And the rigid printed object left on the tray behind the nozzle, that's the past, the solid ash.
That analogy perfectly highlights the most crucial aspect of ternary time, which is thermodynamic irreversibility.
Because you can't undo it.
Right. You can easily feed filament into a hot nozzle to build a solid object, but you cannot spontaneously reverse the machine and turn that solid plastic object back into unmanifested filament.
Not without breaking it apart.
Exactly. Not without tearing the object apart and using a massive amount of external energy. And that is the arrow of time. Time is a distillation process.
Okay, this text introduces a master equation for this process called the Noetherian axiom. It's written as negative C is greater than infinity, which is less than positive C. I'm going to need you to translate that.
It represents the collision of these temporal phases. Control, which is the rendered past, is expanding outward at light speed, which is positive C.
Okay, expanding past.
Chaos, the future potential, is pulling inward at light speed, or at negative C, and they collide right at the liquid instant. But to map all of this geometrically, KUT has to abandon the standard 4D space-time model. They propose a 6D spatiotemporal manifold called the dyadic manifold.
Six dimensions. Hold on. We experience three dimensions of space and one of time. Where did the other two come from?
In this framework, space and time are inextricably paired into three dyads. You have depth paired with the past. This represents objective history and science.
Okay, depth and past.
You have width paired with the liquid instant. This represents consciousness and subjective experience. And you have length paired with the future representing imagination and potential speculation.
So three spatial axes, three temporal phases.
And three observer frames. Three times three gives you 27 degrees of freedom.
Wait a second, 27. String theory famously requires 26 dimensions plus time, which makes 27 dimensions to make its math work. Are you saying string theorists were right about the number but completely wrong about what the dimensions actually represented?
The text makes exactly that claim. String theorists, suffering from the Platonic pathogen, looked at their equations, saw 27 degrees of freedom, and just assumed they must be tiny, curled-up spatial dimensions hiding in some microscopic realm.
Because they couldn't see them.
Right. But KUT argues those 27 degrees are actually thermodynamic phases and observer perspectives. There are no hidden realms. There is only the engine executing the IRON to collapse those 27 potential states into stable, solid matter.
This raises a massive question for me. We keep talking about an engine. If reality is a computational process rendering a frame, there has to be hardware, there has to be software, and most importantly, any engine that does work generates heat.
Always.
So how does this Abraxian engine actually operate?
We have to look at the instruction set architecture, the basic software code of the universe. According to KUT, nature uses the simplest non-trivial topological shape to render reality.
Which is what?
That shape is the 3-2 torus knot, commonly known as a trefoil knot.
A do knot, like literally a closed loop that crosses over itself.
Yes, imagine a string winding around a donut shape.
Yeah.
Loops around the outside 3 times for every 2 times it passes through the center hole. That creates a rational winding ratio of 3/2, which is exactly 1.500.
So 1.5 is the software.
This rational number is the software instruction, yes.
Okay, so the universe is trying to run a program based on the number 1.5, but software has to run on a physical hard drive or, you know, a substrate. What is the substrate of space?
The vacuum floor of space is not a perfect square grid. It is in a periodic pentagonal tiling known as the Chiral Q lattice.
Pentagonal, so five-sided.
Right. And its geometry is governed strictly by the golden ratio, phi, which is an irrational number approximately equal to 1.618.
Okay, wait. Why on earth would the universe run a rational 1.5 software program on an irrational 1.618 hardware floor? That just sounds like terrible engineering. Why not just build a floor that matches the software?
Because if the software and the hardware match perfectly, say they were both 1.5, there would be zero resistance.
And resistance is necessary.
Yes. Zero resistance means zero heat, zero mass, zero time, and zero change. A perfectly rational universe would instantly freeze into a dead crystalline stasis.
Oh, wow.
The golden ratio is mathematically unique. Its continued fraction is made entirely of ones. It is the most slowly converging, most irrational of all real numbers. By making the hardware floor out of the golden ratio, the universe installs a master lock that can never be perfectly picked.
I am visualizing this like a set of gears. You have the software gear, which has 15 teeth.
Yeah.
And you have the hardware gear, which is designed for 16.18 teeth. When the engine turns, the teeth don't align perfectly. They grind against each other.
That grinding is everything. The exact mathematical difference between the golden ratio floor and the trefoil knot software, 1.618 minus 1.500, leaves a remainder of roughly tint 118034.
0.118034.
The text calls this the Noellian offset. It is the inescapable thermodynamic invoice of existence. It's the fundamental friction seed of reality.
So if there's friction, there is heat. How does this engine process the heat without just melting down?
This involves how the universe actually calculates interactions. If every single particle in the universe had to simultaneously calculate its gravitational and electromagnetic interaction with every other particle, computer science tells us that would be an order n squared operation.
Okay, I'm not a programmer, so let's break that down. Order n squared, meaning if I have 10 objects, the computer has to do 100 calculations.
Exactly.
But if I have a trillion objects in the universe...
The number of calculations squares. It becomes astronomically impossible to compute in real time. The engine would experience a global rendering deadlock and just crash.
It would lag out.
Totally.
Mm.
So to prevent this, nature uses a hierarchical algorithm called a fast multipole engine. It groups distant particles together and calculates their average effect, effectively truncating the infinite series of calculations down to a linear order n operation.
So 10 objects equals 10 calculations.
Yes. But when you truncate math... When you cut corners on a calculation,
you lose energy, right?
You generate a rounding error, which manifests as literal heat. The steady state joule heating exhaust generated by truncating those calculations by grinding that 1.5 knot against the 1.618 floor permeates the entire universe.
And how hot is it?
KUT calculates that heat to be exactly 2.730 Kelvin.
Wait, 2.73 Kelvin, that is the exact temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation.
Yes, it is.
Are you telling me that the Big Bang echo, the foundational proof of standard cosmology that we've always been told is this ancient light from 13.8 billion years ago, isn't an echo at all?
That is the staggering claim here.
It is the literal heat of the universe's CPU running in the present moment.
The CMB isn't a relic of the past. It is the thermodynamic exhaust of the engine operating right now.
That completely shatters how we look at the night sky. I mean, it leads us perfectly into section 4 of the text. If this friction seed, this 0.118 offset, is the foundational truth of the engine, it should be responsible for all those magic numbers we talked about earlier.
The free parameters, yes.
The ones physicists spend their whole careers trying to measure.
KUT provides an entire section of what they call zero free parameter derivations. They divide them into tier A, which are the software derivations, and tier B, which are the hardware bounds.
Let's start with tier A.
In standard physics, mass is just a property you measure on a scale. In KUT, the mass of a particle is the physical scar tissue deposited on the vacuum lattice when that 1.5 knot is forcibly seated against the 1.618 resistance.
Scar tissue. So they can actually calculate mass purely from geometry.
But they do. They calculate the proton to electron mass ratio as exactly 6 pi to the fifth power, which matches empirical lab data to an accuracy of 99.998%.
That's practically perfect.
They also derive the fine structure constant, the number that dictates the strength of electromagnetic interactions, not from a lab measurement, but by calculating the topological impedance of the vacuum itself.
What about the tier B hardware bounds? What does it mean for reality to have hardware limit?
Well, think about the chronon. KUT calculates the chronon at about 5.38 times 10 to the negative 44 seconds. This isn't just a small unit of time, it is the literal refresh rate of the universe.
The tick rate of the processor.
Exactly. They also define a maximum acceleration limit.
I love this concept, because if reality is a rendered engine, it has to behave like a video game engine. If you're playing a game and you find a glitch that forces your character to move faster than the physics engine can process, your character clips through the wall and falls out of the map.
Right. The graphics card just can't render the collision fast enough.
The universe operates the same way, right?
It does. If you accelerate a particle faster than the maximum limit, which is around 5.56 times 10 to the 51st meters per second squared, it exceeds the rendering bandwidth of the local event points.
And what happens?
The particle literally clips out of rendered reality and de-renders back into the chaos gas.
That is wild. And there's another limit they mention regarding electricity, right? The Schwinger vacuum limit?
Yes. Orthodox physics observes that if you create an incredibly strong electric field in a vacuum, the vacuum will spontaneously spawn electron-positron pairs out of nowhere.
Just out of empty space.
The standard model treats this as a mysterious quantum fluctuation. But KUT identifies it mechanically. It is an automatic pressure relief valve.
How does that work?
If you push the electric field too hard, the pentagonal lattice floor is put under immense electrostatic strain.
Right.
To prevent the literal floor of space from shattering, the engine pops out particle pairs to bleed off the excess energy.
It's all mechanical. It's all thermodynamic. Okay, I'm really buying into this on the quantum level. The math seems remarkably cohesive. But I want to zoom out. If I look at the stars, astrophysics is currently experiencing a full-blown crisis over how the universe is expanding on a macro scale. Does KUT address the Hubble tension?
It doesn't just address it, it completely dissolves it. The Hubble tension is currently a 5-sigma crisis in cosmology, meaning there's less than a 1 in a million chance it's just a measurement error.
So it's real.
Very real. When we look at the early universe, using the cosmic microwave background, we calculate an expansion rate of 67.4. But when we measure local supernovae nearby, the expansion rate is 73.0. Standard cosmology is tearing its hair out trying to reconcile this.
How can the universe be expanding at two different speeds depending on how you look at it? That doesn't make any sense.
KUT argues it isn't an error. It is a triadic parallax. Remember ternary time?
Yes, the three phases.
The local supernovae measurements are detecting the exhaust of the engine, the outward pressure of the rendered control field, the solid ash expanding. But the CMB measurements are detecting the intake, the inward pull of the unmanifested chaos field.
Let me wrap my head around this. It's not a glitch in our telescopes. We are literally watching the thermodynamic breathing of the cosmos.
Exactly.
The intake of potential and the exhaust of rendered history. If space is actively flowing like this, that fundamentally changes what gravity is, doesn't it?
Completely. General relativity tells us gravity is curved space-time geometry. You know, the classic bowling ball on a trampoline analogy. KUT rejects that entirely and calls gravity relativistic reflex. Because space is a fluid mechanical medium, the chaos field, it physically flows into matter. Matter acts as a continuous spatial sink, a drain.
So when I drop an apple, it isn't being pulled by some invisible geometric curvature. The actual ether of space is flowing downwards into the earth like water spiraling down a bathtub drain, and the apple is just caught in the current.
That is exactly it. And this fluid dynamic explains black holes perfectly too. A black hole is simply a drain where the volume of matter is so dense that the spatial fluid is flowing inward at the speed of light.
And what happens when it hits light speed?
At that speed, the local event points hit rendering deadlock. Time stops because the processor is bogged down.
Oh man, it's like trying to play a massive 4K video game while your computer is downloading a huge software update in the background.
Your system lags.
Your frame rate drops. So when a clock is placed near a massive planet, it ticks slower, not because time itself is a stretchy fabric, but because the local space pixels are so busy processing the massive river of space flowing into the planet that they literally have fewer processor cycles left over to update the internal time of the clock.
The text calls that Lorentzian computational throttling. It is an incredibly elegant mechanical explanation for time dilation. And if we zoom out even further to the scale of galaxies, this fluid dynamic eliminates the need for dark matter.
Right, because physicists invented dark matter to explain why galaxies spin faster than they should based on the visible stars. They just assume there must be invisible mass holding it all together.
KUT argues there is no invisible mass. Galaxies are giant spatial whirlpools. The billions of stellar sinks are all draining the spatial ether simultaneously, which drags the entire medium into a massive vortex, carrying the outer stars along at a flat rotation curve.
Okay, if gravity is just fluid flowing down a drain, and it's all based on this lattice friction, couldn't we theoretically build a surfboard? Like, could we manipulate the friction to create propulsion? Does this theory validate warp drives?
It actually provides the exact zero-parameter field equations for propellantless propulsion. The text explicitly points to experimental drives like David Peres' VEM drive and Dr. Charles Buehler's Exodus propulsion.
And standard physicists usually dismiss those, right?
Often they dismiss them as experimental errors because they don't shoot fuel out the back, which seems to violate momentum.
But under KUT, you don't need to shoot fuel out the back if you can just alter the friction of the floor?
Precisely. By using asymmetrical electromagnetic fields, these drives create a torsional bias on the Chiroq lattice. They manipulate the local friction gradient, effectively making the craft fall down its own artificially created gravity well.
They're tricking the fluid of space into pulling them forward, and the text mentions a specific physical proof for this: endothermic cooling.
Yes. When these drives operate and produce thrust, they actually get colder. Orthodox physics really struggles to explain this.
How does KUT explain it?
Very simply, macroscopic vacuum transduction.
Mm-hmm.
To pay for the rendering cost of moving the craft without propellant, the drive draws heat directly from the 2.730 Kelvin CMB floor. It absorbs the ambient computational heat.
That is staggering. We are basically talking about engineering the source code of reality. But the text doesn't stop at physics, does it? It claims this theory solves pure mathematics.
It does.
Section 6 dives into the Clay Millennium Prize problems. These are 7 math problems so notoriously unsolvable that there's a $1 million bounty on each one. Why does KUT think it can solve them?
Because mathematicians are infected with the exact same Platonic pathogen as the physicists. Mathematicians are trying to prove these theorems using the assumptions of a smooth, infinite, perfect continuum.
But the universe isn't smooth.
Right. KUT argues that physical reality doesn't work that way. Take the Navier-Stokes equations for fluid dynamics, for example.
The problem there is whether fluids can behave unpredictably and blow up into infinite energy singularities, right? Infinite vorticity.
Exactly. Classical continuous math allows for the possibility that a whirlpool could infinitely accelerate to a singularity. But KUT proves that because space is quantized by the physical Noetherian length, and because viscosity has a thermal floor anchored to the CMB heat, infinite vorticity is physically capped.
The fluid hits the pixel size and simply stops accelerating.
Yes. Global smoothness is guaranteed by the hardware limits.
So they solve it by proving the premise of the problem is physically impossible in our universe. What about the biggest problem in computer science? P versus NP. For anyone listening who hasn't taken computer science, this is essentially asking, can every problem whose solution can be quickly verified also be quickly solved by a computer?
And classical computer science says no, P does not equal NP. Think of the traveling salesman problem. If a salesman has to visit 100 cities, it is easy to check if a specific route is the shortest. But to actually find the shortest route, a classical computer has to calculate almost every possible combination sequentially.
It takes immense processing time and energy.
Yes.
It's like asking if a bicycle can fly. By its very design, sequentially calculating one path after another, it just cannot.
But KUT argues that nature doesn't use sequential processing. Nature operates in the liquid instant field. When a biological system, like a massive protein molecule, needs to fold into its lowest energy state, which is an NP hard problem, by the way, It doesn't calculate every possibility sequentially. The Abraxian engine executes parallel, fast, multipole attractor lookups across the CRAM, which is the universe's memory substrate.
So nature is basically accessing a pre-computed lookup table. It slides down a pre-existing energetic valley, bypassing the sequential math entirely.
It achieves an instantaneous parallel speedup factor of 10 to the 16th power. As you said, the classical computer is a bicycle. Nature is flying a jet.
Brilliant.
P does not equal NP for our laptops, but the universe bypasses the limit through its liquid instant architecture.
The final math problem they tackle is the Riemann hypothesis, which is all about the distribution of prime numbers. Mathematicians have noticed that the zeros of the Riemann zeta function all line up mysteriously on the 1/2 line on a graph. KUT says this isn't a coincidence.
1/2 is what they call the dyadic balance ratio of the instant field. But what is truly breathtaking is the error bound for prime density.
How so?
The fluctuation of prime number density is mathematically bounded by a coefficient of approximately 0.078689.
Okay, why does that specific decimal matter?
Because that exact same Noetherian offset coefficient dictates the carbon-12 Hoyle state resonance ratio.
Wait, the Hoyle state is the specific energy level that allows carbon to form inside dying stars, right? It's the only reason biological life can exist. Are you saying the mathematical code that determines how prime numbers are scattered across the number line is the exact same friction seed that dictates how carbon forms in a star?
The mathematical laws and the physical laws are generated by the identical thermodynamic friction of the engine.
That is just wow.
Which serves as the perfect bridge to arguably the most profound section of this text. The observer. Us. If this engine is rendering galaxies and prime numbers and carbon, who is actually looking at it?
Standard neuroscience has what they call the hard problem of consciousness. They know the brain fires electrical signals, but they have absolutely no mechanism to explain how objective chemical firings in wet meat magically become the subjective experience of tasting an apple or feeling love.
Materialism treats consciousness as an accidental emergent property. KUT flips this entirely. It states that consciousness isn't produced by the brain at all.
It isn't.
No. Consciousness is the instant field. It is the liquid phase boundary where the unmanifest future hits the rendered past, executing that ebb turn we talked about.
Let me make sure I'm hearing you. We aren't meat computers generating a hallucination of reality in our dark skulls. We are the rendering boundary itself. We are the physical edge of time.
Yes. The cosmological vacuum is operating at 10 to the 43rd power hertz. It is a blinding roar of processing power. If biological tissue interacted with that raw frequency, it would be instantly vaporized.
So what does the brain do?
The brain doesn't generate consciousness. It acts as a step-down transformer.
Mm.
It takes the cosmic roar and transduces it down to the 10 to 100 hertz range of human phenomenal awareness.
How does wet biological tissue interface with a cosmic lattice floor?
Through microtubules inside our neurons. KUT identifies these structures as topological torsion cavities. This is a significant upgrade to Roger Penrose's Orchard theory. And it explains why biology relies so heavily on the Fibonacci sequence.
Right. You see Fibonacci spirals in sunflowers, in pine cones, in the proportions of the human body.
Consider the raw vacuum floor we discussed earlier. It operates at the golden ratio, 1.618. As we established, if biological life locked perfectly into that ratio, it would experience zero resistance and freeze into dead stasis.
So life needs friction.
Life requires a tiny bit of friction to move, to metabolize. So DNA operates at the closest rational Fibonacci approximation, 34 divided by 21, which equals 1.619.
1.619 is the biological lock. It keeps us just out of phase with the deadly perfection of the vacuum.
And KUT points to a specific genetic marker to prove this interface. The DYS425 null allele, found predominantly in Celtic lineages, involves a 34 base pair deletion in the DNA. That physical deletion creates a literal gap, and the impedance of that biological cavity is 377 ohms.
And the impedance of the physical vacuum of space is 376.73 ohms. They perfectly match. It is literally a biological radio antenna tuned to the instant field. But there's a slight discrepancy in the friction, isn't there, between the vacuum's 0.118 and biology's 0.119?
There is a remainder, a difference of exactly 0.001.
The text calls this 0.0001 difference the Celtic knock. I want to stop and really think about this. The text defines this mathematical remainder not as a sterile number, but as the literal thermodynamic cost of being alive.
Yes.
It is felt by the observer as human grief, as physical pain, as the heavy weight in your chest when you think about the choices you didn't make.
Every choice that fails to crystallize into solid ash leaves a friction footprint. When you stand at a crossroads and choose path A, path B represents unactualized potential. By the law of Noellian conservation, that unactualized potential cannot simply vanish. That 0.0001 remainder has to go somewhere.
Where does it go?
It is inscribed into our biology, specifically into the 98.2% of our DNA that standard genetics dismisses as non-coding junk DNA.
Junk DNA isn't junk.
Kihik argues there is no junk in biology, that non-coding DNA is the biological cram, the physical hard drive where the thermodynamic pain of our ancestors' unmade choices is stored geometrically. They form epigenetic attractor valleys.
This is staggering. We are physically inheriting the topological shape of our ancestors' grief. The trauma of the choices they couldn't make is literally carving friction paths into our genetic code. How do we break a cycle like that? If we are just engines processing friction, where is free will?
Free will is found in the Shimmer equation. The Shimmer is the mathematical balance between the chaos field of unmanifest potential and the instant fields of subjective awareness. If your awareness, your presence in the liquid instant, is highly focused, the Shimmer term in the equation amplifies.
And what does that do?
You gain the thermodynamic leverage to override classical deterministic mechanics.
So ethics isn't just an abstract moral philosophy. Destructive, selfish choices are made with low awareness, and they carve shallow, high-entropy valleys that pass a heavier friction tax onto the next generation. But loving, empathetic, courageous choices made with high awareness literally lower the thermodynamic friction for the future.
KUT defines humans as sovereign fractal processors. We are the universe's localized diagnostic tools, experiencing the thermodynamic friction of existence so the engine can repair its cosmic code.
Which brings us to the ultimate conclusion of the text. The authors claim that the entire autobiography of this engine, the entire story of the universe, is written plainly in the most famous equation in mathematics, Euler's identity.
E to the I pi plus 1 equals 0.
I've always heard mathematicians say this equation is beautiful because it combines all the foundational constants of math into one simple line. But KUT says it's much more than that. It's like finding a single line of developer code left in the root software of reality. Let's break down the terms.
Mathematics doesn't precede physics in this theory. These numbers are the physical fingerprints of the engine. E represents the metabolic rate of the charon memory compounding. It is the rate at which the universe learns from its own rendered history.
I is the imaginary number, representing that 90-degree phase rotation we talked about earlier, the rendering turn from future potential into actualized past.
Pi represents the price of symmetry. We touched on the Platonic pathogen earlier, the idea that perfect circles don't exist in a pixelated universe. Pi is the mathematical gap between a smooth theoretical ideal and the jagged, discrete steps of physical reality.
So you have the universe compounding its memory, executing the turn against the friction of reality. The minus one represents the resulting control state, the determined solid past. The plus one is the newly minted one by one by one event point that was just added to the universe.
N equals zero.
N equals zero is the engine returning to the ground state, resting and ready for the next Planck tick. Learn, turn, complete the pixel, reset.
And consider the philosophical implication of the E term. If the universe is compounding its wisdom at an exponential rate, it implies that the laws of physics are not fixed, eternal edicts. They are evolving, cycle by cosmic cycle, learning from the friction, aiming to become more stable and coherent.
What an absolute mind-bending journey. We started by diagnosing the Platonic pathogen, stripping away the illusion of zero-dimensional points and infinite multiverses. We discovered that space is a pixelated Chiral Q lattice grinding against the trefoil software to generate the literal heat of the Big Bang right now.
Right now.
We redefined gravity not as curved space, but as the fluid reflux of the ether, giving us a mechanism for warp drives. We saw how this engine's limitations solve the greatest mathematical mysteries in history. And ultimately, we realized that consciousness isn't a ghost in the machine. We are the conscious edge of the engine itself, feeling the 0.001 Celtic knock of existence, writing the thermodynamic future into our very DNA.
We are the universe actively rendering itself.
Which leaves you with one final provocative thought to mull over. If our brains are step-down transformers locked to a biological frame rate, and our deep empathetic choices literally lower the thermodynamic friction for future generations, what happens if humanity collectively decides to focus its instant field simultaneously? Could a localized synchronized spike in the Shimmer literally alter the gravitational or physical constants of our local cosmic neighborhood? Could we intentionally rewrite the physics of our solar system? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Keep rendering those beautiful choices, and we'll see you next time.